Hello, welcome to another episode of The High Ground, powered by Premier Companies. Jeff, how are you doing today?
I'm wonderful, Sal. How about yourself?
Outstanding.
Who you got for us?
We got a special guest in the podcast room with us today.
Live and in person.
That's right. We have Megan Taylor. Glad to have you with us. And I know Megan's dad from way back. We used to work together over in Ohio, and you're following in your dad's footsteps.
Yes, I always tell people the first agronomist I ever met was Dave Taylor. It's my dad, and he's probably the best agronomist still. I mean, when I get stuck, I call him.
That's awesome.
So
you've got a good a lifeline. You got somebody you can call. So,
oh, yeah.
And I bet he answers your calls first when they come through.
Well,
you'd like to think so.
I want to say yes, but I would say most of the time I got to text him first and be like, hey, I got a long question. He's like, okay. So just depends on when you catch it.
Well, Megan,
before he probably likes all the consulting fees that you pay him.
That's right.
He does like that.
Yeah, I bet.
Megan, with Bear, before we get to introductions, we have a question of the day that we always start off with. And the question of the day is, if you're going to play a board game with your friends or family, which one would be your favorite? And then also a follow-up question is, which board game do you despise above all others?
This is a good question. I don't know if this is a board game. We considered it one. We would play Yahtzee. Mm-hmm. That was like the thing to do. And when I was younger, I played it with my grandparents, and they told me that's what gambling was.
Yahtzee?
Yeah. They were like, well, this is what people do at casinos. I was like, oh my gosh, this is wild. That and gin rummy, those are the two things we probably,
yeah.
I mean, we still play both of those, but the one I really don't like is Monopoly.
Oh, yeah.
Older sister was always the bank and a lot of fraud.
A lot of fraud. so
makes fraud. It hard. I don't know the better way, because we couldn't count when we started playing it, right?
Sure.
And she was older, and she'd be like, oh, yeah, you know, let me take a cut for the bank. So anyway, bless her heart. So
that's funny.
Lots of fraud.
She's not in banking today, is she?
No, thankfully, no.
Okay, that's just checking.
That career path didn't work out.
Okay.
Jeff, what would be yours in the Jared household?
I would probably say that my least favorite would probably be Monopoly and Candyland. And that's just because I think our kids just wore us out on Candyland. And you get to the point where you have to cheat to get that game over with.
Yeah.
But, you know, and I don't know, we played a lot of board games lately. It's been more euchre and stuff like that. But I think one of the board games I used to like, I haven't played it for a long time. You remember Risk?
Yeah.
You had to go conquer the world.
Yep.
I did like that one. Haven't played it for years, but that was fun.
Well, at our household, we go in spurts, we'll play some games and then we won't, but Clue was always fun. I mean, we'd enjoy that one. And I may be calling it the same game, but Chutes and Ladders.
Hmm.
And that may be the same as Candyland.
It's very similar.
Yeah, I hate in the same way. That
little kids love it, though.
Oh, my gosh. This is the most... Yeah, that's, I've got no patience for that anymore. I don't care if I ever play again. So, Megan, tell us a little bit about yourself and how you got here with the your career path and with Bear and some of your responsibilities. So just kind of give us, introduce yourself to all of our listeners.
Okay, so I'm originally from Central Indiana. I grew up in Jay County around Portland. And I went to Manchester College. That's where I got my undergraduate degree. And then I got my PhD at Purdue. And so after that, I went out to Nebraska for several years and worked for University of Nebraska, Lincoln, as an extension agronomist. So we had our on-farm network, and I was part of that, where we worked with growers, and they put out the trials. We'd help them take all the data, and then at the end of the year, they would actually do all the updates for the faculty at UNL. So it's really cool.
Wow.
If you've never read the On-Farm Research Network, I would highly recommend. And I really enjoyed it out west. And then I got an opportunity to be a professor at Murray State, which is in West Kentucky. And so I ran the student research farm and had some grad students and undergrad students and did pre-commercial testing there. And that's how I met my Bear folks. And Randy McElroy, who was a TDR over in Illinois, so a technical development rep, he actually was like, hey, we have an open position. I think you'd be a really good fit. And one thing led to another, and now I've been with Bear as a technical agronomist for about a year and a half now.
Very good. And moved to Southern Indiana?
Yep. So I live in the mighty town of Mitchell. So if you've never been to the Persimmon Festival, you got to go check it out. Super nice. If they need a tourism group, I could help them out. But yeah, it's beautiful there. The Spring Mill State Park's there. So my husband and I moved there. And so we really enjoy it. And I have a really good team. I cover Southeast Indiana, and we have some of the best growers in this part of the world. I truly believe that. And then our retail partners are awesome. So we've been really, really blessed.
Very good.
Awesome. Awesome.
All right. Well, one of the topics we want to talk about today was we'll get into fungicide season. Years ago, we didn't have the airplanes flying. Jeff, you and I have been doing this for a while, and growers were pretty selective about what they sprayed fungicides on from a row crop perspective. But that's changed a lot in the last decade. And thought maybe if you could just kind of give us kind of some technical information about why we spray fungicides today, and why the practice, I guess, has gotten so much more popular.
Yeah, I think that's a really good call out, is that I think anymore it's not a question of, you know, are we going to spray it? I think it's more of a when, how many times, what's the product, what's the rate? And I think that that's been one of the things I've seen. Even I've only been an agronomist for 10 years, full disclosure. But
only? That's still pretty good.
But
you're way ahead of Sal.
Yeah.
Bless his heart. So for 10 years, I mean, I would say from when I started to now, it's definitely become more about that finite timing, right? So I do see us kind of transitioning in corn and beans to saying, okay, like I have this much yield on the table. Do I need to spray at V5 and Tassel? Is that my best timing? Or what product do I lead with? So I just think that a lot of it's just come down to, we have products that have hybrids, I should say, in varieties that have higher yield potentials. We also have a disease, new diseases emerging that, you know, it makes it so we have to do those things. So tar spot, some white mold now moving down into southern Indiana, which we historically haven't seen that. And I would also say we've adjusted our planting practices where we're planting earlier. Mm-hmm. We're really pushing the envelope because we want that additional yield. And with that, you have to do some extra management. And sometimes that is fungicide. So,
very good.
Yeah.
You talk about the yield potential of these hybrids and varieties and stuff, and it has, you know, greatly grown over the years. And then we start hearing about these diseases. Were the diseases always there, and now these high-yielding varieties and hybrids are more susceptible because they're higher producing, or is the disease getting, you know, worse for some other, you know, environmental reason?
That is a really good question. And I think that there's some diseases where, you know, we've had them longer, like gray leaf. I think a lot of us are more used to it. And I think a lot of that kind of stems from, for gray leaf specifically, is that we kind of went to corn on corn, or maybe we knew corn was higher value, so we would, you know, not rotate as often. I don't necessarily think it's directly related to the hybrids being more high yielding, but there is also the school of thought. It's like, okay, you drive in a Ferrari and the Ferrari goes 100 miles an hour. If you try to turn, you're going to crash, right? So you see that impact a lot more than if you're going 30 mile per hour at a more moderate pace. Turn, you're like, oh, okay, just a little bit of a turn there. So I do think maybe that could be part of it, but I just think that the disease that we're seeing now, I think part of it is we have changing climate. I think part of it is we have more intensive farming practices. We also went to no-till, so we have more residue there. And I also think the crop rotation probably feeds into that as well.
Okay, good.
Yeah.
You mean the crop rotation, more corn on corn, or?
I think more corn on corn. And I think now, like, we used to have pasture, or we used to have alfalfa, or we used to do summer annuals, maybe, like, you know, people had cows and livestock where they were really running something different over it every 2 to 3 years. And also our reduction of wheat acres in some instances. That's true. I think that's also contributed when we think about these diseases we see year after year.
That's good insight, because we do not have the wheat acres that we did a long time ago, and we certainly don't have the alfalfa patches or the right. pastures that we rotate around, and those were very common.
Yeah, hay's down, and you know, and a lot of the wheat went away, just, you know, disease pressure and stuff, and it just got to be one of those, you could have a beautiful wheat crop, and then it's like fog would roll in May, and your beautiful wheat crop was, you know, not very good anymore, so people went away from it.
Yep. So the timing, you mentioned the timing, Megan. So kind of, there are two schools of thought, and we have kind of a vegetative applications of fungicides, and also, the crops, in more of a reproductive stages. So, can you kind of tell us a little bit about the difference and why we would apply at either time?
This is a good question. I think And I talk about it a lot. So I'm just like trying to think how I want to put it together.
Okay. And maybe tell us what is your best case practice, what you recommend.
I think the best case scenario for a grower who has to cover a lot of acres, which is most of our growers, is in corn, thinking about that tassel pass, the R1 tassel pass. Like that is something I think that we really should hone in on, because historically and over many, many years in different environments, we see the most yield potential, saving yield potential at that point.
Biggest bang for your buck.
Right there. Yep. And then in beans, it's very hit or miss. Beans, it feels like that R1 between R3, it just depends on disease pressure. Yeah. So that one's a lot more, I think, driven by the year we're having and the moisture that we have. But then corn, when we talk about the V5 to V6, or even up to, I'd say, like a V10, V12 pass, that's where we start to have a little bit more of a gray area. And part of that is we have a new product. So when we, or it's not our, not mm-hmm. Bayer's product, sorry, but we have some new fungicides on the market that you apply them at planting. And then they provide that early season control, you know, up to V5, V6, and then a little bit of residual through the rest of the year. And with that, it's like you're controlling that early season pressure for foliar diseases, but how much does that actually affect yield long term? And I think that's where a lot of people have that like confusion. But I think the big thing that we've noticed, and we've done some work on it, and I could talk about that too, but the biggest thing I've noticed is that when you have that V5 to V6 application, you're protecting that early yield potential, so the girth that can be formed for that corn plant. And then when we think about girth and length as we go up into a tassel, right, that is also just a time where we don't want the corn to be stressed out. If you want to like compare it to like a person, when you're a teenager, you're a mess. You know, you're just like stressed out. You're like, oh, I'm angsty. That's kind of what corn's doing from V6 up until tassel. It's just angsty. It's like, you know, I got to like fight the power.
As a parent, you just got to keep the teenager alive so you'd be a productive adult. So,
and that's what that early season fungicide would do. It reduces the stress on the plant through that angsty phase that corn has up until tassel. And then when we think about that tassel pass or R1 pass, that keeps, again, low stress for the corn during grain fill, and then also like reducing tip back. So I think you just think about it in three phases. The early season really helps us with girth and length. And then if we switch over to the reproductive phase, that helps us with also length, but also weight, right? Because we get paid in bushels. And so that R1 pass, that helps us with the weight and also reducing tip back. So that's why I think the timing is so important. But again, this all would still go back to, if you have disease pressure, you need to do something. So like last year's a really good example. We had tar spot really early, yeah. V6 corn. And everybody was like, well, it's a late season disease. And I'm like, well, this is V6. And so, I mean, we did make a lot of early season passes. And from our research that we did across Indiana, I mean, we looked at a 1 versus a 2 pass, and the difference between those was 15 bushels.
Wow.
And that's a lot. And even just the single pass at V5 still had an impact on total yield from an untreated. There's a 20 bushel difference between those.
Just at a V5 application?
V5 only.
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 That's remarkable.
We didn't do anything else to it, mostly because we needed to see if that V5 was actually a doable pass for people, right? We need to make it pay if we're going to recommend it. So it did.
In the presence of tar spot this case.
Yeah, we had heavy disease pressure, and then also you add in the drought layer. And that drought layer last year was just, we had 14 days no rain, 21 days no rain. So it was never, I don't want to say a true full-on drought, but it was these flash droughts. And again, that stress on the corn exaggerated what we saw from the disease pressure and also the stress response of the corn. And fungicides can also reduce stress responses. So like strobilurins is a really good example. So that'd be group 11 products. They can reduce the amount of ethylene, which is a hormone that basically tells the plant, hey, you need to grow slower. Hey, you need to senesce, or you need to start to like pull back, maybe die a little, ripening, right? And so it reduces the production of that. So that reduces the stress response on the plant.
You know, we had those dry patches last year that we went through. And then I would hear these yields coming off. And it's like, you know, these guys are rolling 300 bushel corn off. And I'm like, what would this stuff make if it actually rained all summer? And so, you know, what you're saying holds true. I mean, you know, these things went through some stress, but and these guys made fungicide applications, and I'm just amazed at the yields out there. That's that makes sense.
What about so that's corn. So what about soybeans?
Oh, soybeans always kind of like, everyone's like, it's the stepchild. But for me, I think soybeans, we could probably really do a lot more in terms of like being more consistent with application. So for fungicide and soybeans, I would say that the times it's going to pay the most is when we have wet springs and also when we have wet conditions leading up to reproduction. So like, for example, if we get a lot of July rains, which we historically haven't in the past couple of years, that really sets up those dense canopies to be very, very prone to getting like frog eye leaf spot or even a white mold situation or septoria. And those would be the instances, or if you have bottom ground that has a lot of fog, like you were talking about earlier, that's another area where a fungicide for me on beans, that makes a lot of sense. There's still some discussion on whether it should be at R1 or R3. Historically, we make them at R3. There's a little bit of discussion about trying it earlier at R1 to try to retain flowers. So when I was still at Murray State, we were testing this because in the South, we do double crop. And I mean, we have some double crop here as well, but we had double crop and then we also had single crop soybeans. So I would spray them around the same time. So R1 double crop beans as well as the single crop beans. And in double crop, I could get like a 4 to 5 bushel response from fungicide at R1. In single crop, it really just depended on humidity, moisture, that's really what drove it, disease pressure.
Yeah.
The R3, though, interestingly enough, enhances the stay green potential of the soybeans. So they dry down a little bit slower. And what we saw is that typically we had better seed weight. So that was something that I don't know has been super well described in our body of literature as agronomists and scientists, but that is one thing that I noticed is when we use a combination product. So whether it's a group 3, 11, 7 product or just a 3, 7, but some combination product, we saw that it enhanced stay green. So the leaves stayed intact longer and that we had higher seed weight. And that was in soybeans that were anywhere from a 3.5 maturity all the way to a 4.2 maturity. Hmm. So it's kind of an interesting maybe side note there, but something to look out for.
Very good. I got a chance to hear Dr. Belo some 10, 15 years ago when he said that if you're going to be in there and spraying, and I know that your dad would have went to the same camp of integrated pest management, but Dr. Belo said it, if you're going to be in there, you might as well use insecticide. Basically, that wasn't his exact words, but he acted kind of implied that the combination, the whole of all the nibblers and the different insects that are present, whether they're grasshoppers or June beetles, but just to put an insecticide in, I know we try to be good pest management, but is that a good practice? Is that something that, since we're there and pyrethroids are cheap and plentiful, is that a good idea to take care of those while we're out there?
I think it depends.
Yeah, sure.
I'm going to say, the famous agronomist right. answer. Oh, gosh.
Yeah.
Oh, bless. So I think it depends. I would say historically, it depends on bean leaf beetle. You know what I'm going to say. But I would say in general, anything you can do, back to Dr. Belo, anything you can do to preserve green leaf material is going to enhance yield. Yeah. I mean, that's just the long and short of it. So if you have pressure, sure. Right. If you have grasshoppers, if you have bean leaf beetle, thistle, caterpillars have been one that we've seen more and more because they get blown from the Southwest. I mean, there's just other pests we have out there that we don't really in beans think about as much all the time. But anything they're doing to defoliate, especially the middle part of the canopy, because that's where most of the yield for soybeans comes from, is from like the 7th to 12th node. Anything we can do to keep those leaves green and active, you're going to see yield impacts.
Very good.
Yep.
Interesting. What you talked a little bit about plant health and you talked about, you know, beans staying greener into the fall, a little slower dry down. you know, it's amazing to me to watch corn plants anymore. You know, used to, you could sit there and go, hey, that thing's, you know, it's starting to turn brown and we're going to see the ears drop. Now these corn plants stay green. And the next thing you know, it's like, hey, the combines are going and this corn's still green. So, you know, just, obviously you can see the guys that use fungicide because of that plant health. What does that speak to as far as yield and that, in that grain fill time and stuff like that? You know, what advantages are you seeing by using fungicides?
That's a really, I'm really glad you asked this, because last year when we did the one versus two pass, I was kind of worried that I wouldn't be able to know where the line was. Oh, I didn't need to worry, because the thing is, as soon as you walk from the V5 only into the treated to the two pass, so the one that had the R2 application, I mean, the plants are green, they're healthy. I mean, mostly intact is what I want to say. But again, it's similar to soybeans. Anything that you can do to keep the plant photosynthesizing longer, you know, that helps you with grain fill. Now, the only issue could be like an early in, early out situation. It is going to be wetter. Like, that is one thing, is it will retain more moisture. Now, again, normal dry down for something that's like a 115 below for the RM. So, you know, I'm more along the lines thinking like 120 or 118 day corn. If you spray that too late with fungicide, that's going to be pretty wet corn, right? So that would be the only
department might want to start.
Oh my goodness.
They might want to start recommending fungicides, come out with a program so they can sell more gas to dry corn. I mean, we may be onto something here for the propane department.
That's probably the only propane fungicide, you know, crossover. Yes. It's the crossover you didn't know you needed.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think also from a, like in DVI, so actually from, if we measure if it's photosynthetically active, it was. I mean, there was a very big difference between the photosynthetic activity between that one pass versus the two pass, just for the stay green piece of it. But there is also, I guess, a word of caution is between different hybrids, there's very different stay green potentials, right? Mm-hmm. So there's some hybrids that are going to be more or less responsive to fungicide. And some of them are going to be more or less stay green responsive. And sometimes people are like, well, you know, stay green, that really drives the yield the most. And in some cases, again, as long as it's photosynthesizing, I would agree with that. But there's just some plants that are darker. And in humans, we tend to go to things that are more uniform in color. So we're always attracted like, oh, that looks like good corn. But there are some products that they don't really have good stay green, but they still have really good yield potential. So, yeah, there could be some differences there.
Interesting.
Very good. I've got another question, but it's kind of off topic from fungicides, but these brown stink bugs, I mean, they are a nuisance. It seems like they've gotten worse every year. And we had kind of hoped that that cold spell that we went through in January would knock them back a little bit, but it seems like they somehow have survived. They're still around.
Because they keep coming into my house.
I know. Yeah. And they're just, they're so nasty. Nothing will eat them. It doesn't seem like they have any predators. So what should we do about those in the crops? They have different problems for different crops. In corn, that early stink bug damage it's by the time you see it, it's too late. All right. I mean, and then in soybeans, creates another. Can you talk about stink bugs just a little bit, just for the?
Yeah, of course. Yeah, stink bugs. Oh gosh, bless them. Stink bugs are in corn. Like if you've ever gone through and you've walked corn early, and it looks like Wolverine's been there.
Yeah.
Like they sit with their head down and they feed on the whorl as it's developing. So that's why you see those rips in the corn. And again, from an early season standpoint, it just reduces, you know, the photosynthetically active material, right? And also the common smut that just opens it up to have smut and stuff. When we think about stink bugs early, I mean, again, you can run when you're posting your corn either early or even if you follow the planter, you could run an insecticide and that would be an easy option to get rid of those. The only bad thing about doing that is usually the insecticides you'd spray at that point, they kill everything, right? Yeah. So they're going to just nuke everything that's out there. But if you've had historic issues or if you have a lot of grass around the field or like if you have a field that has like 10 waterways in it, that's like a perfect example.
Okay.
Because they can Makes hide sense. There and then they can go whoop right out into the corn because they want to stay where they have things to feed on and then they'll move out. And there's lots of other insects and things for them to feed on and also plant material there. Then when we think about them in soybeans, so in soybeans, they're more annoying because they actually attack the pods. And so they can attack the pods, and then they create these small like micro cracks, and then you can get water into the seed, and then the seed swells. And again, I would say when you're spraying for your fungicide at R3, you could also include an insecticide there to reduce their population, because they have an incomplete life cycle. So that means that like they start as juveniles or like small stink bugs. You probably have seen them where you're like, ugh, and then they get bigger and bigger and bigger. And when that shield is fully formed, that means they're mature, right? So once they're mature, they're harder to kill. So if you can get them in the nymphal stages or when they're smaller, you usually can have better control over them.
Very good. Yep. All right. Jeff, that's about all I've got for today.
That was informative.
That was very informative. And this is almost like a home game, not too far from Mitchell.
Yeah.
So that's good.
Yeah.
Megan, thank you very much for joining us.
That means
us.
We can have her back more often.
I think so.
Yeah.
That'd be good. Well, thank you for joining us today. And I know that our listeners appreciate your insight on the fungicide market and just helping keep the plants healthy and getting through this season.
Yeah, thank you guys for having me. And if there's any other questions or anything, you can reach out to me. The only thing I would add is if you have any interest in some fungicide data, or if you're making that decision, Crop Protection Network, it has all of the local data from Purdue, as well as all the land grant universities on every fungicide. Wow. It'll tell you good, very good, how it handles different diseases. So it's free. I would use it because, again, taxpayer dollars go to fund that. So it's cropprotectionnetwork.org. And again, free to use, really good resource, easy to use.
We can link that to the podcast.
I think we could.
Yeah.
All right. Well, that's another episode of The High Ground, powered by Premier Companies. Thank you all very much.